Baby, and stay tuned for Jay Cornick and the Dearborn Journal. You're listening to WHFR Dearborn.
Stepping out with my baby, I can't go wrong, cause I'm in right. It's for sure, not for maybe, that I'm all dressed up tonight. Stepping out with my honey, can't be bad to feel so good. Never felt quite so sunny, and I keep on knocking wood. They'll be smooth sailing, cause I'm trimming my sails. In my top hat and my white tie and my tails. Stepping out with my baby, I can't go wrong, cause I'm in right. Ask me when will the day be, the big day may be tonight. I'm in right. It's for sure and not for maybe that I'm all dressed up tonight. Stepping out with my honey, can't be bad to feel so good. I never felt quite so sunny, and I keep on a knocking wood. They'll be smooth sailing, cause I'm trimming my sails. In my top hat and my white tie and my tails. Oh, stepping out with my baby, can't go wrong, cause I'm in right. Ask me when will the day be, the big day may be tonight.
This is WHFR Dearborn. Yes, it is time. You recognize the new theme song now? Yes, it is time to get down to the bones of the matter. That's the joke anyway, from the Bones TV show soundtrack. And we're going to start our public affairs show for this week. It is Friday, April the 10th, 2009. Good Friday to those that observe that. Also, the beginning of Tiger baseball, I guess, in Detroit. How exciting is that? And but we have more excitement than that going on with local news and views here on this show, Alternative Views. And we also do, of course, cultural notes of significance. And in the studio with me, starting off our show today, is a special guest, Jerry Jablinski of the HFCC Theater Department. Welcome, Jerry. This is the microphone check. So tell us about the new play offering that's coming up on the main stage of Adria Auditorium in the next week.
Yes, indeed. It is Homer's epic poem set into a dramatic context by Derek Walcott, The Odyssey.
Wow.
That's it. Yeah.
Well, I had the pleasure of reading The Odyssey in college several times. I actually took my intro literature survey classes from a classics professor. So, of course, he snuck in all the great classics from that period. And let's just give people a little background on this. First of all, it is an epic poem, as you said, but it originally was an oral only sort of experience in the Greek culture, if I remember correctly, for and they yes, think indeed. It might have not been written down. It was written down maybe about 2,000 years ago in the classic age of Greece, but in fact it may actually have been originally composed 1,000 or more years before that.
Yes.
So this is one of the great stories. I mean, if a story is good and not just, you know, does it have a lot of excitement and action adventure? But if the story touches on universal human themes about civilization and so on, then it's more likely to be remembered by people and repeated in one form or another for centuries, if not in this case, millennia, which is absolutely amazing to me. Maybe you want to give a little other background on the Odyssey?
Well, in the Odyssey specifically, it's actually kind of part two of the two-part epic poem, right? The first part being the Iliad, the story of the Trojan War, which most people know from the abduction of Helen or the running away of Helen to be with another man and the attempt to get her back and the long war that ensued and the trick of the Trojan horse to get inside the walls of Troy. And so Odysseus, one of the brave warrior kings, was part of that group that went to Troy to regain Helen. And that's the story of the Iliad. Then the Odyssey begins at the end of the war as they are getting ready to return home after this long, horrible ordeal. And what should be a relatively short boat ride home to his homeland of Ithaca turns into a 10-year allegorical journey of the trials and tests that one must face outside of war in more normal living conditions.
We've got a cookie on the desk here. Is that, okay, our former DJ, DJ from the previous period. Thank you to Roger White, by the way, for handling the big band show today. I understand that big band Bill had to leave early. So always great to have Roger in, and along with all the other things he does here at the station. Got to make sure the cookie goes to the right person here.
That's very true.
For a while, I thought it was payback for bringing you on, Jerry, but that's okay. And I understand the Odyssey, and this is how significant the story is, folks, is that at least one theory about the oral poem of the Odyssey, along with the Iliad that you mentioned. And of course, for people that don't know either one of these stories, I don't know if they're required very much in high school or even in college anymore. I mean, it might have to take a classics course to actually get to the Iliad or the Odyssey, which is unfortunate, I think. But it was remembered. And it's a very long poem, and I don't know how many lines were in the original poem, but I know the paperback is like 1,000 pages or more. Although I understand in Greek it rhymes beautifully, and so it's a little easier to remember as a poem if it's rhyming and consistent meter, I guess. But that they thought Greek civilization used the Iliad and the Odyssey with kids as the key teaching tool about what their society was all about. So all the values of their society, the principles that their home and family and even warfare and their concepts or their versions of heaven and hell or what the afterlife is going to be, that was all encompassed in both the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Yes,
it's just
indeed.
It is unfortunate that the story of the Iliad, of course, the last movie version starred Brad Pitt and was called Troy.
Right.
And a lot was left out, of course, of the story. And I wouldn't even say it was all that close to the value of having read the poem version.
Right. It was more of an action-adventure version of the text.
The last film version, I think there was a mini-series that was on, like, American Movie Classics or BBC or something, which went on for like 5 or 6 hours. But I know Hollywood did a version. I think Kirk Douglas played Odysseus. Mm-hmm. That was the 40s or early 50s or something.
Yeah, somewhere in there.
And one of the highlights for you action adventure fans, folks, and asked Jerry if all these things are included, of course. But I remember that there's a stunning battle at the end, and it's Odysseus and his son who battle like 50 suitors, 50 noblemen who were trying to win the favors and marry Penelope, Odysseus's wife, who was valiantly kept them at bay for 10 years that they've been waiting to marry her. And so how much of that are you getting in there? I mean, it's only, maybe a 2-hour play or three. Well,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Rightly so. There's a lot of really good stuff. I mean, a mm-hmm. lot of really fantastic scenes. Anything about this adaptation? I mean, about the who wrote it?
Yes. It's a wonderful
Eric
adaptation.
Eric Walcott. I remember that name. He's mm-hmm. a poet.
Yes.
By trade.
A Nobel Prize winning poet.
Name dropper. Okay.
I found this version and I just fell in love with it because he has such a command of language, and he does take liberties with the story as any adapter translator does. Mm-hmm. But he is so wonderful between going back and forth between these wonderful poetic images and this just regular colloquial language about how people talk to each other when they're talking about friends, enemies, love, mm-hmm. Difficulties, etc. And so that's part of what I love about the piece. Another part is that not only does it move through space, because it's a journey, right? Mm-hmm.
10 years, yeah.
Right, yeah, so a lot of different
10 years
locales.
And 3 hours, okay.
but also through time. And so it's eclectic in that sense, and we reflect that in our production. It moves back and forth through ancient Greek times, through World War II, and he makes allegories between totalitarianism and the loss of democracy in Greece, and some wonderful movement in that way, and captures many of the major events of the original story. The other thing about it is that there's some wonderful comic moments. The first scene with the Cyclops, when Odysseus meets the Cyclops, is just so wonderfully delightful, and without making the story silly at all, creates some beautiful comic moments as well. Plus, he wrote some songs. He wrote the lyrics for some songs. The narrative voice is actually done by a character named Blind Billy Blue, who is a singer, representing the minstrel voice, which originally created, or the several minstrel voices, maybe Homer wasn't one person, maybe he was many,
right.
That created the story. And so we have three different composers composing the music for the songs, and there's also a couple of dances in the script because it also moves to the Caribbean, right? There's a there's a voodoo ceremony there, reenacted, not a real one, of course. So there's this wonderful combination of time, space, music, song, dance that keeps the story just moving splendidly as well.
When I first read The Odyssey, I borrowed it when I was only like 10 years old from my public library, and I'll mention Flat Rock, Michigan. Okay.
Excellent.
Yeah. Well, but the problem was that they wouldn't let the unabridged version of the story mm-hmm. be checked out by anyone under the age of 21.
Sure.
So my version of the Odyssey didn't have like Circe's enchanting and mm-hmm. seduction, and
right.
It went on about a year out of those 10 years. She kept him on her island, mm-hmm. Odysseus on the island. Of course, mm-hmm. he was enchanted, folks. He really wanted to get back to his wife. This is a great tale of faithfulness
yes.
and dedication, certainly, if anything. I mean, talk about realizing duties of many sorts and persevering. Mm-hmm. But he finally did escape from that. But we do include some mention of Circe.
Circe is a critical part of three different scenes mm-hmm. because, of course, the seduction, the manipulation, the enchantment, whatever words you want to use for that, or the attempted seduction of Odysseus away from his main goal, which is to get back home and back to his wife and son, is a significant part of the story that is definitely included.
Both of these epics, if I remember, there is a scene where the lead character briefly goes to their version, or in those days, their version of hell, which was called
The underworld.
The underworld.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
And get some information or perspective on their situation so they can come back for the final climactic mm-hmm. action and resolution of the story.
Mm-hmm. Of course, prophecy and mysticism was part of the Greek culture, just as it is part of all great major religious traditions. Mm-hmm. And the methodology that was used in this particular context was, yes, the descent into hell to talk to the dead to gain more perspective on the time and effort and how life works in the long term. And yes, there is a scene that actually takes place in the London Underground. The London subway system becomes the metaphor mm-hmm. for the underworld.
Well, we really do move around, right? Not just the Eastern Mediterranean locale, but this is definitely sort of a modernized interpretation.
It's very easy to understand and very easy to follow. It does not follow the ancient Greek rhythms and the old language. Of course, the names of the characters are maintained.
I hope so.
But it's very easy to follow.
Sounds like an epic production. We're talking with Jerry Jablinski here and just trying to give you some background on the Odyssey, the epic poem by Homer, Greek poet from thousands of years ago, in this great translation adaptation by Derek Walcott. And Jerry's the director of this play. This must have been an epic undertaking, too. I mean, the cast must be, unless you have people playing four or five roles, pretty large. And the set design, all these different locales, lighting in that, this is a big deal. Something that, I mean, it's really unique that I think the people of Dearborn and the surrounding area definitely want to get to. It starts next Thursday, folks. Give you all the details in just a second. So I hope we've whetted your appetite here. But tell us a little bit about pulling together this as a production on the Adrey Auditorium stage here at Henry Ford.
Certainly. Well, because of the epic nature of the show, we have a cast of about 18, and yes, most of the actors play multiple roles. All of them, except the actress who plays Circe and Odysseus, play more than one role. And the actress who plays Circe is also doubling as our stage manager, so she has a lot to do. And so we have about 200 costumes. Because it goes to so many locales, we have what's called tabula rasa staging. That is, the stage is essentially empty, and we set the locales by bringing on a piece of furniture or by flying in a drop. And then, of course, what was inherent in the poetry of that time was we tell you where we are through the dialogue, mm-hmm. and of course through the action.
This is really essentially the way that the Shakespeare had his plays presented mm-hmm. in his day and time. This
yes.
is that the stage setting wasn't as significant as what the characters were saying and their costumes and their attitude and a few props that they brought with
yes.
them on stage and carried off. So there's actually, that's the only way you could accommodate all the scenes, in fact, is by just that suggestion of the most significant details.
But, yes, indeed. So. And that is, in fact, the way that it's written. Mr. Walcott's parents were amateur Shakespeareans, and so he comes from a background that was very familiar with that approach, and it works very, very well.
Well,
in the telling of this story.
I think everybody wants to go see it now. And true, this is Easter weekend, but hey, this is going to be next week. Starts next Thursday, folks, April 16th. After your taxes are done, you can get some culture here. And really, you know, the price of theater these days, like at the Fisher, or if you ever stumble to New York City and see the ticket cost, you won't, even on a discount ticket, you probably just spend $60 to get a third-rate seat. And I'll just mention the prices here. Adults, $12. Students, $10. Groups of 10 or more, only $5 a seat. And the ticket information number, I'll read it here, and we'll be making other mention of this throughout this next week, Jerry, just so you know. 313-845-9817. That's your usual ticket information and reservation number. 313-845-9817. For more information about the Odyssey, and it'll be continuing through Sunday, April 26th. So it's Thursday through Sunday, and I assume, yes, I'm looking at the notes here. It is Thursday through Saturdays at 8 p.m., and Sundays, 2 p.m. only.
That's correct.
So,
Yes, indeed.
If you go to bed before 8, then Sunday would be your target. But this is just going to be one of these very, very, well, I think they're all special at Henry Ford because of you, Jerry, and of course, George Popovich, and all the other folks. For example, here, costumes by Judith Fletcher. She's not hyphenated anymore.
Okay. No.
Her last name used to be hyphen something else. And original score by one of our own adjunct music professors, Anthony Lai. Is it Lai or Lai?
I believe it's Lai.
I think it is L-A-I anyway, folks. And he is a young man who's very, very talented. And so he wrote the original score. That is the music that goes behind the words that are already there.
Along with two other composers, one student and myself.
Oh, well. Uncredited on the poster. I guess they can only get so much in, huh? You always make a significant creative contribution to all aspects. Of course, the set design, that's one thing that you're always into, too. It says choreography by Janine Bodery, and I haven't seen her name associated, but maybe she has been doing
choreography before. She has been an adjunct faculty here with us, mm-hmm. and she's also the director of the Prism Studio for the Arts, and she directs her own dance company, who is guest performing as part of this performance.
Great. So song, music, dance, adventure. Is it sword fight at the end? Is it using swords or fisticuffs too a little bit?
The suitors, right? Yes, yeah. As you mentioned earlier, they are confronted by Odysseus because they have made, as he puts it, a pigsty of his house, attempting to marry his wife, although she has remained faithful to him while he's been gone. And so we represent that battle with some special effects and some exciting fight choreographer. We also have a fight choreographer, Jim Pichet.
Oh, wow.
Who has contributed to the production as well.
Yeah. Fight choreography is a special skill, certainly. And that's something you can't just do, get out there with that sword and start waving it around. I mean, and there's danger involved, but also you want it to look realistic and exciting, too. And so it's good to have somebody that has those special skills. And most of the actors are in theater classes here.
Yes, all of the actors are current students, with the exception of the actress Blaine Surtsey. She is an alumni of our program, and she's now in the U of D Mercy acting program, and she's graciously given us her talents for this show.
Well, the theater program here, too, at Henry Ford Community College, folks, as is also true with the music program, it's current students and former students, alumni, that are part of keeping it all going. And in 1 week, in fact, it's the week of the Odyssey, we're going to be starting our annual pledge drive here. But the theater program deserves your support, too. And we've been running that PSA for contributions to the theater fund ongoing, because these are just so unique, folks, and not just WHFR, but the theater program here with its unbelievably exciting choices of plays and the way that they get the cast and the crew so enthused to challenge them and you, the audience, too. I mean, all the other civic theater groups are fine, but I think you'll find that we do very unique things, and we do them especially well, considering the difficulty of and the lack of models in the area. Some students might come out of high school with some theatrical experience, but we take them the next step, certainly. That's my perspective on it. So anything else you want to say about the theater program?
Yes, indeed.
And well, this play?
To tag on to what you were saying, yes, we want our students to continue to be successful, and most of our students end up transferring to BA and BFA programs as the next step in their training. Mm-hmm. And we have a very wonderful virtual theatricality lab, which uses motion capture and rear screen projection. And helps to train actors for film acting, which, of course, is an industry that's moving into the area. And in terms of this particular production, we have the audience seated right on stage on three sides of the action. Mm. So it's very engaging work for the audience. I also want to mention two other people, Brian Tereshevitz and Alex Carr, who are some of our adjunct faculty who've contributed a lot to the technical production end of this show as well.
The Odyssey, folks. Homer's epic poem, dramatized, adapted by Derek Walcott, Nobel Prize winning poet, right here at Henry Ford Community College Theater Department and the Adrey Auditorium, our fine arts building here on our main campus, Evergreen and Ford Road. Hope you can make it over here sometime between the 16th, next week Thursday, and 2 weeks from this Sunday is the 26th. So Thursdays through Saturdays at 8 p.m., Sundays at 12 p.m. Jerry,
at 2.
At 2, I'm sorry. Yes, of course, at 12. How did that get in there? I added a 1. At 2, of course, which is a traditional time. Again, the phone number for more information or reservations, if you have a group of 10 or more, or even just want to reserve a few adult tickets or student tickets, you can use that voicemail of this number, 313-845-9817. I'm certainly going to not miss this production, Jerry. This is really unique, and I know it's going to be done extremely well. So can you say break a leg to the director?
You can.
Okay, that's a term of luck and endearment, I hope, in the theater business. That's not anything nasty. Thanks so much for being with us on the new WHFR Journal, Jerry.
Thank you for all of your support now and in the past, Jay.
Looking forward to the Odyssey here, 16th through the 25th of this month. Okay, we have a number of things coming up on the show next, and I think, first of all, an op-ed. Okay, it's going to take a second for her to get into place, but one of our staff here, our news director, Susan Morrell, heard the show last week. And, of course, that's always scary when I hear people say, I caught your show last week. And then I'm thinking, oh, boy, I'm going to hear it now. Well, she has some comments, but she wanted to say them on the air. So I don't know what she's going to say. Well, I kind of do. But so we're going to let her come on. Not everybody gets this opportunity. And it's not going to be equal time, folks. But we're going to let her say what she wants to about that. Let's see here. We have a couple of public service announcements that we want to mention, and we'll be right back with more of the new WHFR Journal right after these.
Saturday, April 18th, to kick off the WHFR Pledge Drive Week, we'll be hosting a night of live local music at PJ's Lager House. Located at 1254 Michigan Avenue in historic Corktown District. The show will include the Dead City Prophets, Lost Viking Del Morto, the Free Dirt Band, National Ghost, and the Czars. That's five bands for $5. In addition to the music, we will be featuring Dueling Theremins. Come on down and see who rules the sound waves. For 23 years, WHFR has been supporting our community. Now you can show your support by joining us at PJ's Lager House, April 18th. At WHFR, we don't just talk about supporting local music, we're doing it.
WHFR's Radiothon 2009 Blues Concert will take place on Saturday, April 25th at the New Place Lounge, Michigan Avenue in West Dearborn, and we hope that you will be there. Our benefit will feature the live blues music of Robert Penn.
Let's have some fun, way we used to do.
CeCe Collins and Soul Purpose.
No. You see, I like Chicago, but I got to get back to Detroit.
And David Gerald and Insurrection.
Hey, baby, get out town for me.
Only a $5 donation at the door lets you in, and food and beverages will be available for purchase. 21 and over, please. That's Saturday, April 25th, starting at 9 p.m. at the New Place Lounge on Michigan Avenue in West Dearborn. Please join us for a night of great blues music and support WHFR, independent radio since 1985.
We're back with more of the new WHFR Journal for Friday, April the 10th, 2009. Things are very, very exciting here on campus, and not necessarily in a good way, although I don't believe, I don't know the extent of the situation. So tune into your local fear-mongering TV station at 5 or 6 tonight in the Detroit area, and you'll see what probably occurred here. I understand the news media are already outside, and not to interview me, but everything seems to be okay on our campus at this point, and I do not know the extent of the incident, as they're calling it right now. But you'll find more. It's always interesting to find out what's going on in Detroit. And it's not always good news, unfortunately. So we are joined now by Susan Morrell, our WHFR news director, who caught the show last week, as I said, and has a couple of comments about some of the things that I said, and get us into local news and views. I do have the local papers with me, and thank you, Times Herald, for giving me a copy this morning, since I didn't get to my house during the usual delivery time, although I understand that happened to several people. In fact, let me briefly read just I love these segues. Whenever a topic comes up and I've got a story that relates to them, before we have Susan Morrell's comment, I'd like to read this from Jack Lessenberry's column in the Metro Times, just a small comment about the news and the newspapers in Detroit. You know, the Detroit News and Free Press have ended home delivery, I think at least 4 days a week. And this is the situation as Lessenberry sees it. We mentioned last week how he was saying that his first week of this new situation was terrible because he didn't get the papers when he wanted them. He got his Free Press at 4 p.m. in the afternoon. And, of course, the Free Press is a morning paper, so you're 6 hours out of date, at least, if not eight hours out of date, if you get it in the afternoon. So he goes on here to say, how bad is the Detroit newspaper experiment? Worse than even I could have imagined it would be. On purely mechanical grounds, Dave Hunke and the Detroit Media Partnership clowns have taken incompetence to a new level. Yeah, Hunke must be the in charge of the partnership, the corporate entity that is controlling the news and the Free Press at the same time. That's Hunke, H-U-N-K-E. I hate to call him just Hunk, the Hunk. It's probably Hunky. Example, says Lessenberry, I did not get a Wall Street Journal all week. Reason, it had been delivered by the now mostly laid off newspaper carriers. So more people out of work there. Thursday, a Wall Street Journal operator told me, quote, the people running the Detroit papers really messed this up. We are trying to find a new delivery system, unquote. Lessenberry went on, I shouldn't feel bad. I at least got the New York Times. A friend of mine, Gross Point, didn't get his New York Times either. As an experiment, I signed up for mail delivery of both papers. The Detroit News never came at all. The Free Press, to my surprise, came every day by 4 o'clock, so that's mail delivery. Okay, that's why it came so late, probably. But the news in it was many hours older than the paper you can buy in the newsstands. On Friday, my carriers, last week Friday, threw the papers in a planter full of water, so I can't analyze them very well. For whatever baffling reason, they did bring me 2 Sunday Freeps. I have never seen an uglier or more wretched paper, and that is saying something. One longtime Free Press editor wrote to me, quote, most of it reads as if it had been written, so-called, in quotes, for someone with an IQ of 52. I should just mention that the IQ of a normal adult is supposed to be 100. Okay. Adding, I give it till December, this Free Press editor said, if that long. In other words, he doesn't think the paper is going to survive in the print form at all, since they apparently don't have good writers, and now they don't even have good circulation because they don't have reliable delivery. Maybe it'll improve. Another reporter, just to conclude this, who has hotly defended the paper against my criticism in the past, said simply that he was giving up. As he said, quote, the designers have taken over, even more so than he did when Gannett was ruining the Detroit News in the 90s. The designers, that's probably, I would call them the bean counters, the people that, you know, are going for the lowest common denominator and jazzy looking pictures. And I almost expected to become a tabloid soon just for circulation. That is a smaller size paper, but a tabloid has all these juicy crime photos supermodels looking fat in their bikinis and things. Although it's strange, you can't find many supermodels in bikinis in the Detroit area, certainly, but I bet they'll dig them up somehow. And so things are pretty bad in that regard. I saw an ad today that the New York Times is, other than the Wall Street Journal, they're the only game in town. If they can keep reliable delivery, I saw an ad on the internet today that in the Detroit area, it's only $3.35 a week to subscribe to the print version of the New York Times. Now, whether or not that includes the Sunday edition, I don't know, but, you know, or maybe it's just a come on for 16 weeks of a lower price. But that is a fine paper, folks, and anything big in Michigan that happens, by all means, it's in the Times also. So, and now we bring on Susan Morrell. And how are you today, Susan?
Yes, Jay, I'm very well, thank you, and good to be back. And I was listening to your show last week, and you had a couple of topics on there. Of course, the CEO of GM, Rick Wagner, getting fired by the president. I have to say, I don't think it's appropriate for the president of the United States to fire a CEO of any company. That is not his job. That is not why we elected him. Furthermore, shouldn't the board have done that? The board of GM have done that? And if they didn't do it, Obama got on television, he gave a news conference, and he laid out the rules to the big three. But I didn't hear him give an ultimatum to the people running AIG or the people running the banks on Wall Street, who've gotten much, much, much more bailout money from the government than the big three. I mean, and Obama was supposed to be a man of the people. He was supposed to be for the working people. We have all these union people here in Michigan. And I get the feeling that Obama is not really supportive of union people. Just what he did, I think it was wrong.
Okay, if I can add on to that. First of all, GM in taking, they asked for the government bailout, and so the government has a large say in, and I don't know the exact legalities of it, but they certainly have a large say on how that money is going to be spent and how it's going to be paid back, and I haven't seen the agreement, but I think it does give them these strings. Now, unfortunately, the first so-called TARP money that went to the banks from George Bush and his Secretary of the Treasury didn't have any strings attached at all.
Yes, but I don't see any strings as far as Obama's money other than to the big three in Michigan. Where are the strings?
Well, they're under the gun. GM was under the gun. They already took government money. They said they need more. And Obama said, I'm asking, it was his decision, and whether it was symbolic or practical or whatever, to ask Rick Wagner to step down, which is just a fancy way of saying you're fired. GM allowed this to happen, their board or whatever. So we don't, the government has not nationalized GM. Okay, so the government is not running GM, but as long as they want government money, they're going to have to meet some guidelines. Now, I agree with you on the second part that you stated, and that is it'd be nice if there were some guidelines in place about Wall Street, too. I have a Jim Hightower comment about further excesses on Wall Street, which is, I know, an easy shot, as I said last week, but some interesting details that he brings up too. So, right, I don't think the president should merely go around and say this company, that company should, fire their boss. However, if they ask for money, then they're asking for strings, and especially if they want more money on top of it, they're going to have to negotiate. And I think Rick Wagner, if you want to see it this way, was one of those negotiated criteria for additional funding. Because Wagner did not present, first of all, an acceptable business plan to save GM by the deadline. And so I
certainly think there are major offenders who are getting handouts from the government who really are the cause of the economy going sour. I mean, certainly AIG and the Wall Street banks with all their derivatives and all their hedge funds and all their crazy financial arrangements that nobody even understands, they were the cause of all of our troubles. And certainly some of those CEOs, those heads should be rolling. And the people who came back and got all the bonus money from AIG and they were in the derivative department, hello, they shouldn't have received those extra bonuses. And that was Obama's people. That was Timothy Geithner. How is that fair?
Well, it happened under Geithner, but you realize it had been part of contractual obligations that had been set up years before. And it wasn't really, it was special payments, but it was retention money, as they called it. So it was not like a bonus for a job well done. It means if you continued your work there, then the agreement made years before said that you would continue to get this extra amount. So, if it was a bonus, especially for work, a job well done, you know, or profit made for the company, they shouldn't get those. And my understanding was these were retention payments. Although the crazy thing is that people, I think about a third of them, took the retention payment money and then quit.
Yeah, but I mean, how
because
can
the company was not doing well anyway, so they thought I better leave while getting is good. And of course, some of the not many, but I think about a fourth or even less than a fourth decided to give back the money since the big media flap came out.
But how can that argument hold water, Jay, when the unions in Michigan and the unions all over are constantly asked to renegotiate? You're a teacher, you're a professional, you've been a member of a union. There's unions all over the country. And they're always asked to come back to the table and renegotiate their contract. Mm-hmm. These are legal contracts. Mm-hmm. They're constantly renegotiated in the face of new conditions. So that argument doesn't hold water. We hear a little background music. That's Jay's phone ringing.
A little blues tune there. Sorry, almost no one ever calls me. But
no, but how does that argument hold water? Seriously, can you respond to that?
Nope.
He won't.
No, I think that, obviously I'm a populist, someone like Jim Hightower. I was trying to think of the exact term for me. I'm an independent, progressive, populist, libertarian, Green Party person, which is contradiction in thousands of terms there. But I do think that right now in this society, there is a big divide between rich and poor. And the poor includes the middle class, and there's not many in the middle class anymore. And in terms of unemployment rates are mostly of the middle and lower classes, not the upper classes. The lifestyles, not just of the rich and famous, but those making whatever criteria you want, whether it's 100,000 or more or 250,000 and more, are quite different these days, quite different than the people below that level. And so, we have a real economic divide in this country. I think also an educational divide, digital divide is called too, because the rich people, they can get iPhones like mine, and wireless internet, so they can be connected everywhere all the time to all the information. And the people that are unemployed or in the poverty level or even in the lower middle class, they can't afford these things, which would in the long run help them out. We have many problems. And I do think the answer, as a teacher, everybody sees things from their own perspective on the world. And after 40 years as a teacher, I think we really have to improve our educational systems. And it's not just by paying teachers more money, but we've got to redirect our energies to the real needs of the future. I do think in terms of academics, science and math, and let's make studying and learning exciting for our students, as it should be. And they're going to need all the help they can get in the future, and we need them. I mean, they are the future. Whatever we do now, even if we're brilliant about coming out of this crisis, it won't hold in 5 years. In 5 to 10 years, our children will be taking over, or our grandchildren, depending on our ages. And it's if they're not ready, we'll be in a worse mess. You know, so we have to make some investments now, and hopefully all we can do, since so many things are happening on so many different topics, I give Obama credit. He's trying to move ahead on almost every issue at the same time that he talked about. But we collectively, I'm sure, each have disagreements about how some or all of those things are happening. And we need to let our elected representatives know. I talked last week about how email is very efficient.
Yes, I know you did. Yeah. But, you know, I don't want to give any president, even if I voted for him, a carte blanche.
No.
You know, that I'm not going to be critical of what's going on. And, you know, his whole cabinet is composed of millionaires, Obama's cabinet. They brought that up on CNN today.
Yeah.
And so, you know, well, naturally so they're deciding in favor of the banks and not the union jobs, you know. But let's go back to the other topic that you talked about last week, which was Afghanistan. And my understanding of Obama's campaign when he was running for president was that he was against the war, and that was the war in Iraq.
So. Yeah.
But so far, I don't see very many soldiers coming home. And then and Afghanistan, he never really gave his position on Afghanistan, and this is really becoming Obama's war, Afghanistan. I mean, I know you're not in favor of it, and neither have I.
Well, if you remember, during that extended 2.5 years of primaries and campaigning for president, the Afghan war wasn't going all that badly. I mean, there wasn't we weren't losing too many troops. We thought, well, maybe we can just get out, you know. Well, things have gone become much, much worse. The Taliban or Al-Qaeda or whoever the resistance groups are, the tribal leaders, have really been rising and in number and rising up and attacking our troops more. And so now it would be a major embarrassment for him to just get out. But he could rightly say, I want to get out because, you know, at that point, because we weren't doing too badly in Afghanistan. I made the point last week that, you know, it's a losing battle. For example, these days, outside Somalia, there's all these pirates. This is southeastern African coast, folks, who waylay ships, cargo ships usually, hold people hostage, try to get the ships to port to steal all the cargo and resell it. Now there's a boat captain of a U.S. Ship that is being held in some dinghy or some small boat, and our battleships don't want to attack because they're afraid the guy is going to be killed. And he tried to swim for it this morning, but the pirates caught him. And it's just pathetic, almost. But the whole point is that, remember, years ago, you're too young to remember, maybe, but Clinton took us into Somalia. We had a war in Somalia. We took our troops to Somalia to straighten them out.
Well, Jay, I have to get...
But we realized Somalia was a failed state, and now it's more failed than ever. There's nothing legitimate. It's a bunch of, they have their own interesting narcotic that they all smoke, and lawlessness, corruption, no government that can take responsibility, no hope for change. You drop goods off there, they'll sell them, they'll steal them. It's a failed state. I'm sorry to say, I think Afghanistan is a failed state, too.
I agree. I agree.
If they can say that now about Somalia, which is why we got out, because all our troops there, we couldn't win that. There was nobody that would put the country back together. And we even couldn't, because all the people were not of that mind.
If you say that Obama is moving ahead on all of his campaign promises, we could have universal health care today if we weren't fighting a war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If we would bring the troops home today, we would have universal health care in the United States.
Right. Right.
Right?
We could afford it. Yeah. We could almost afford it anyway.
We could afford it.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't be spending our resources over there anyway. Yeah. What is the point of being in Afghanistan? I don't even see the point.
You know, it's supposedly to try to use Obama's words in a brief fashion here, and then we're going to play Jim Hightower. It's supposedly a situation, as I understand it, of trying to eliminate Afghanistan as a staging area an organizing area of the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or both to attack Pakistan.
Oh, yeah. Don't get me going on that.
No.
Not only that.
But Pakistan doesn't want our troops in Pakistan, but they are allowing us to send our drones into their mountains to attack some of the footholds there. But Afghanistan can be, if we're not in Afghanistan and it's mountains and all that, freely going after them, there's going to be more of them going after Pakistan. And in fact, Pakistan is a more worthy target. Don't they have nuclear power and other things? And so Pakistan is a country that the Taliban, if not Al-Qaeda, would love to take over. But we're not getting much support from Pakistan,
so
which is a Muslim country too.
Tell me this, Jay. Why did Obama authorize $1.5 billion to go to Pakistan and aid? There's another $1.5 billion that it could have gone to pay for universal health care here in the United States for American citizens. I mean, these are issues that we did not vote for him for these reasons. We didn't expect him to do these things.
We've got to go here, folks, and move on. I'm going to play Jim Hightower's commentary about excesses among the rich here, and we'll be right back after this. Thank you, Susan Morrell, for your comments, and we look forward to your Pet Lovers Lane returning tomorrow. Maybe,
yes, huh? Absolutely.
Okay. So more with the new WHFR Journal after this Hightower comment.
With the recent downturn in the fortunes of Wall Street barons, you might think it's all doom and gloom within New York's highest circles of plutocracy, but not so. Take the sorcerers in the mysterious world of hedge fundery, where unimaginable profits are spun from exotic bets on other people's misfortunes. For example, one of these wizards reaped $2 billion in pay last year by betting that the housing market would crash. What a winner he is, huh? And even though annual bonuses for top-shelf Wall Streeters are being cut down to the low millions of dollars each, their plucky families still make do as best they can. The New York Times reported recently that a pricey restaurant on the city's exclusive Upper East Side exists as a haven for these beleaguered elites. As the wife of one Wall Street big shot says, "I started going there with my girlfriends for lunch so we could all have kind of a comfort zone. A simple lunch of shrimp over greens served with a glass of wine tops $50, but who's counting? These regulars don't actually pay the bill. Instead, the restaurant keeps a running tab for them, sending a monthly total to their bookkeepers. There's a division of labor here," explained a regular. "I don't keep all that stuff in my head." Meanwhile, even as the economy tanks for regular folks, over-the-top extravagance still has a home in New York. For example, a new residence tower will afford its elite clientele an ensuite sky garage. When you arrive at this high-rise building, you pull into a car-sized elevator that automatically recognizes your vehicle and lifts you and your car up to your floor. You then drive your car forward into your personal garage attached to your suite. The elevator goes back down and you step out of the car directly into your residence. This is Jim Hightower saying, isn't it good to know in these tough times all across America that excess is still alive and well in New York City?
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current. Even a dead fish can go with the flow. Now available wherever books are sold.
The report cards have come out and I'm afraid we're just not making the grade. I'm talking about the infrastructure report card issued every 4 years by the American Society of Civil Engineers. The engineers do an analysis of the condition of 15 categories of our country's crucial infrastructure, including roads, drinking water, parks, schools, and levees. The latest report scores us a big fat D. Our actual performance is even worse than this poor grade indicates, for America was rated a D+ in 2001, meaning our officials have let these public assets deteriorate further in the past 8 years. The engineering group says that our leaders ignore essential upkeep on our national house, relying on what the group calls patch-and-pray fixes. The group reports that it'll take a concerted national effort costing $2.2 trillion over the next 5 years to lift America to a grade of A, where we belong. That's 18 times the size of the infrastructure funding in President Obama's current recovery plan. But at least his plan makes a significant start for moving our country in the right direction. Meanwhile, there's another plan that the Obamacans are said to be considering that has special merit. It's a grassroots proposal to reactivate the enormously successful Civilian Conservation Corps that Roosevelt launched in the Great Depression. The revitalized CCC would enlist thousands of young Americans in all 50 states, putting them to work on the huge backlog of reconstruction projects so urgently needed on the 700 million acres of both urban and rural public lands across our country. This is Jim Hightower saying, let's put Americans to work on jobs that really need to be done, building national assets for future generations. For information on the CCC idea, go to wecantakeit.org.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go With the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
We're back with more of the new WHFR Journal. Make work projects like the CCC, not a bad idea. I think they worked in the 1930s, and I'm sure they could update the idea from roads and tunneling through mountains to maybe some ecology projects.
I'll go.
Okay. Just take this. We're getting a phone call in because of the special thing. So.
Okay.
And Susan Morell's here in the studio with me, and we're answering the phone like crazy. Here are some headlines from the local Dearborn papers.
We're wrapping up.
We did mention that Councilman Bob Abraham is going to pay his back taxes. What's interesting is in the Times Herald that I just got this morning, the Election Commission has changed the affidavit for council candidates. And what this means is now if you want to be a candidate for council, it says in the affidavit, in the petition, I am not an officer of a company or a corporation that is in default to the city of Dearborn. It's quite clear that not only is it personal property you can't be in default of, but property that is in the city of Dearborn that you own as part of a company. And the city charter, of course, makes no such reference, but it's now in that affidavit. Kind of slipped that in there. They could call it the Abraham Clause or something. He's going to run again. And, of course, I was critical 2 weeks ago. Sorry, Bob Abraham. But if you were just able to up and get a loan or take out your savings and pay the $80,000 when the question came up, why couldn't you do it along the way? 2.5 years of back taxes. The average person couldn't wait that long, I don't think. But you're to be commended for paying them, but you were kind of forced into it, I guess. Oh, well. And we're looking through the paper here. We're going to try, despite the fact that we do have a situation here at Henry Ford Community College. I was just told that the police have closed the campus. We're going to try to get Joanne Korchinska in through the door. We're going to sneak her in with police escort. And I'm not kidding. It's not a joke, folks. You'll find out on your major TV news channel. Who knows? They might have police choppers above the place. But as far as I know, the situation has been resolved here. Maybe there's something ongoing. But just for safety's sake, they have closed the campus. Another good point raised by Michael D. Albano, the guest columnist in the Press and Guide. He's the one that wrote a column a couple weeks ago that talked about the situation in East Dearborn, because he drove up and down all the streets. And so he's got a very nice column here. He went up and down the West Dearborn streets and those businesses that are still there. He gives a nice little plug to them and indicates again that we all need to start shopping in downtown West Dearborn again, or we risk losing even the remotest chance of resurrecting that once wonderful district. He concludes by saying, more importantly, if downtown West Dearborn fails, then our city fails and we will have an empty shell of a city. So, Susan Morell, do you have a comment on that?
Well, we don't want an empty shell of a city, that's for sure. You know, we want people to shop and go out to lunch and dinner in Dearborn. And we're getting a lot of phone calls today here on WHFR.
We're going to give this one back to you.
And here I go again on the phone.
Mm-hmm. So So I'll continue trying to finish up here. And, okay. Now, I didn't get a chance to read the Times Herald that well. Sorry about that, because I got it late today. And let's see. Okay. In the Press and Guide from Wednesday this week, this is a curious thing. It seems that there was some sort of arbitration hearing having to do with 19th District Judge Mark Summers, an employee that sued him and the city, Julie Pucci. And the city is going to have to pay $7,400 because the U.S. District Court Judge David Lawson, who's overseeing the case, said that the city's negotiator didn't show up at this particular session, and they were supposed to. I'm telling you, this is crazy. This is pretty crazy. Yep. Okay, so grants may help cities be more efficient. And story here on 3A about Dearborn and Dearborn Heights, about building codes and $78 million in grant. And they're using the money, and this will help. This is the best way of helping in the future. We're using the money to continue getting energy efficiency at a higher level and energy savings and cost savings, and that'll move us into the future faster than can be believed. It's an investment in our future, along with, of course, the education program. Interesting comment in letter to the editor here as we're concluding the show, and that is that the auto industry is being treated with arrogance. And I think Susan Morrell sort of summed that up about Rick Wagner being fired. And so my point is, hey, they asked for the government money. They asked for the government to get involved. And now they're asking for more because they failed the criteria of the first government bailout. They failed to get an acceptable plan submitted back to the government. And I don't think they want to give back all the billions that they got in the first place. So before they get more, I mean, they're the ones that tied their hands by asking for government money. Okay, and then, you know, it's a negotiation. It's a deal. Government just should not, I'm sure you all agree, just give taxpayer money with no strings attached like the Bush administration did with the first TARP. These were the strings. Now, maybe you disagree. You think, well, Rick Wagner is a great guy or Rick Wagner is not a great guy. But as far as the Obama administration saw it, they wanted him to leave, because they wanted something better. They wanted something different out of GM. And so I don't see it as just Obama telling a private company what to do. You know, not private as soon as you ask for government money of billions of dollars, because you have to negotiate that. There's some criteria there, you know, each way around. So I see a number of students coming back into the building here, so maybe the shutdown of the campus has let up. Obviously, they had a lot of people sequestered outside the building, and now they're all coming in here. Maybe it's because it's cold out there. They didn't want them all, if they're waiting for a ride or something. If the building, the campus is closed, it's probably safer to sequester them in this area. And I'll again, tune in to your major news networks. I don't have all the information about the incident. It was serious, and